Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Daytona Beach International Airport, offering new nonstop service to New York City and Boston, Massachusetts. Daytona Beach International Airport features convenient access to the terminal, easy and close parking, and more. Details at flydab.com.
While Central Florida continues growing, its largest public school district is shrinking. Several schools could shut down soon, and we're learning it may not stop there. Falling enrollment and policy changes are reshaping public education. You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Sharon Stone. It's Thursday, January 29th, 2026. Orange County Public Schools are weighing plans to close 7 schools next year. On Tuesday, the school board met to review the proposal to consolidate the students from the 7 across 17 other schools in the county. Hundreds of parents attended community meetings with OCPS leaders recently, held over a 2-week period. That's where we met Michelle Harris, who has twin boys in second grade.
I am feeling very confused. This came about in December. They came, had a meeting, they as OCPS, saying that there's a possibility your school may close, and we'll talk about it in January. So when January comes, they come prepared, right? They already have their maps out. They've already rezoned. They've already selected a school for us, provided no resources for our children or parents, getting us emotionally or mentally prepared. They're going to, I feel like, place us in an unfamiliar environment, and then we just have to go and figure it out ourselves with no type of support with transitioning from this school to another school.
Harris is concerned about how the move could impact her child in and outside of the classroom.
As parents, we have to figure out how to prepare our second grader to transition to a new environment. I'm more of a family that's pretty much established, so my children has a routine. So this is going to completely take them out of their everyday routine, and I just don't want it to affect them emotionally, affect their mental health. They'll be losing their friends, their teachers. Just having the feel of a culture here at this school to be placed into a different environment. So I'm just hoping it doesn't impact them in a negative way to place them in that type of environment. My children are honor roll students. They are always on AB honor roll, always high performing students. Being placed into a different environment, it may affect their testing scores, right? They don't have the same support with the same teachers. And then who knows what their curriculum is there. Like, none of that information has been provided to our school. I don't even know what grade that school is. So, like, they're just deciding to place my children, which could be placed into a failing school, and that's concerning to me.
The schools on the chopping block are McCoy, Bonneville, or La Vista, Chickasaw, Eccleston, and Meadow Woods Elementary Schools, along with Union Park Middle School. Natalia Velez says the process has left families feeling powerless.
It's confusing because they are not saying, like, it is that they are closing, but we know they are closing, you know. They're just saying, we have another meeting, we will make the decision, but I think the decision is made. And since they are already saying the rezoning and showing the two schools that we have, you know, like an option, so it means it is done. The decision is made. I have a few concerns.
Velez's 8-year-old son, Jose, is in the gifted program. He attends McCoy Elementary, which partners with Cypress Springs Elementary for its gifted program.
We ask Jose, hey, what do you want to do? Do you want to go to Cypress and we maybe need to move? Or do you want to stay here and just choose a close, you know, like the closest school? And he said, like, wow, this is a tough question because I like Cypress. I have been going there for gifted and I like it, but I also like being here with my friends. I have my life here. So for us as parents, it's like, oh my God, this is a tough question. I don't think we can change this decision. Just think what's the best decision for our kids.
OCPS says it has lost 8,600 students over the last 3 years. Nearly 6,000 of those students didn't return after last school year. While reviewing proposals to consolidate 7 schools, members of the school board expressed their frustration with their options.
Every one of these meetings have been extremely difficult. As board members, this is like your kind of worst nightmare to have to stand in front of parents and discuss possibly closing or consolidating their schools. I really appreciate the staff and what you guys have done to minimize movement and just kind of keep it as simple as possible. Keep the majority of kids, you know, like a big group of them going one way and a big group going another way.
I want my constituents to know that we really have exhausted every means possible, and that as Member Ferrant and Chair Jacobs, you all have reiterated, none of us want our schools. It's hard to stand in front of parents and community people, especially if it's a legacy school like Eccleston is, to say we have to consolidate.
The decision to close schools comes along with a $41 million reduction in operational revenue for the 25-26 school year, according to the superintendent. Some members of the school board expressed frustration with state leaders, saying they're not supporting their institutions.
The fight is going to have to be in Tallahassee. They're going to have the holy boldness to fight and say that more money needs to be put in public education. The fact that this district for years has been able to keep schools that have been underpopulated funded, and it has not been a problem. Why? Because we've had the money. But now that we don't, it's just not fair to those schools that have 900 or 1,200. We have to pull from them to help supplement those with the 200 or 300. Then you're still living 300 without the need, the financial help. So, of course, I don't want it to close. I don't ever want it to close. I'm always say no. But I do understand that we're in a conundrum that we have to work out.
And during that meeting, Superintendent Maria Vasquez made it clear this round of closures may not be the last.
I wasn't going to say this, but we're projected, I believe, for another 5,000 fewer students next year. And so while I wish I could sit up here and say this is the last of our consolidations, I'm afraid that that would be an untrue statement.
After hearing from parents and school board members, it's clear they don't want to close the schools. To better understand how the district says it reached this point, we're talking to Scott Howitt, Chief Communications Officer for Orange County Public Schools. He talks about how they're advocating for public school in Tallahassee this week and those concerns we heard about from families.
There has been confusion about the status of the 7 schools discussed for consolidation. As of today, are those schools scheduled to close?
It's two parts. The board on December 16th gave direction to the superintendent to move forward with school consolidation of the 7 schools. There's a process that takes place that would include community meetings, rezoning, which includes rural development meetings. They had their work session this week, and then they'll do a rural development meeting next week. And then the final decision is at the board meeting on March 10th. That's when the decision to consolidate the schools will be final. We're moving through that process because the board has provided direction to do so. And we wouldn't be doing this to the communities, to the staff, if we weren't intending on moving forward with consolidation. Is it final, final? No, that will happen on March 10th, but we're moving towards that and moving through that process.
So it's a foregone conclusion? This is going to happen?
I can't speak for the board or say that ultimately the board will, how they're going to vote. I don't know. What we do know is the board provided direction to the superintendent to move forward. We've done the things that we've needed to do when it comes to providing the community meetings, the rezoning, the public input, both in person and electronically. I know that we're moving through the process to get to the outcome where they can vote ultimately to consolidate the 7 schools.
What do you say to parents and families who say they felt blindsided by consolidation discussions?
I just say that these discussions are very difficult. They've been difficult for us talking about them, you know, at the leadership and district level, very, very difficult. And, you know, I personally have gone and presented at half of the meetings that we've held, and they're hard. What I would say is that the timeline for this was accelerated because of decisions that were made during legislative session last session.
What about the families worried that their school could be next? What should they be paying attention to right now?
Some of the things that we look at when we're looking at school enrollment is how many students reside within a school zone and how many students are attending versus that attendance. And is there room for the school to grow, to increase in enrollment? We know that for an elementary school, for example, that operationally, in order to ensure that all of the resources necessary that support students outside of the classroom, principal, assistant principal, media specialist, guidance counselor, that they're paid for through having enough students enrolled within the school. That kind of break-even point is 680 students. So we look to ensure that our schools are close or approaching that number, and that if there are schools that have students within their zone, they don't attend the school, but they potentially could, then that's some area for growth and trying to pull them in. And, you know, anything that parents can do within their schools to help talk up and promote their schools, there's nothing like that grassroots advocacy for a school. We will be providing assistance to principals and best practices on helping to get their message out for the amazing things that are happening within their schools and to get out there. And so drawing them in. And I think that's a big part of trying to solidify the schools that we have and make sure that they continue to operate efficiently, because we have a duty to the taxpayers of Orange County to ensure that our schools are run efficiently. We don't want to cut programs because a school has less students, and that's what would ultimately happen.
The superintendent said enrollment losses are likely to continue. What is driving those declines across the district that people should be aware of?
Our strategy right now is to address declining enrollment. And there's many factors that are outside of our control. Declining birth rates has been really significant. While we had some of the highest birth rates in 2007, and those students are now graduating from high school. In fact, last year we had our largest graduating high school class. We're seeing much fewer kindergartners entering the system, and the expansion of universal choice under the taxpayer-funded vouchers has also given parents the opportunity to homeschool, send their child to a private school. Those pressures have caused declining enrollment, and certainly things that are outside of our control. I think another has been immigration policy. The changes over the last year in immigration policy has impacted not just in Orange County student enrollment, but statewide. And specifically, we've seen since temporary protective status has been removed for countries like Venezuela, we saw a loss in 1,200 Venezuelan students from last year to this year. And so we've seen a total of 2,500 immigrant students not show up in our schools, whether they're staying at home, whether they moved out of the state or out of the country. You know, we're still trying to determine some of that, but we do know that they're not in our schools.
So you're trying to do budget long-term planning with this outlook. Is Tallahassee listening to you?
I think Tallahassee understands the situation we're in when it comes to declining enrollment. Our concern is that as enrollment declines, the funding that was tied to the students that would have been funded if they were present, that funding is somehow reallocated back to the students that are there so that we can preserve some of the programs and the other benefits that we have for our students and families while declining enrollment's happening, because funding is t- tied to the student. If the student isn't there, then the funding doesn't come. But the funding was still generated through the state. So what we're advocating for is to reappropriate that money to increase student funding overall in order to help provide the additional supports that we need for our students, for our families, so we can continue to provide them the highest quality education possible.
Scott Howitt is Chief Communications Officer for Orange County Public Schools. A school board rural development workshop is scheduled for next Tuesday, and there will be public comment. The school board is expected to make final decisions in March. We know this issue touches many people across Central Florida, and we want to hear from you. Send an email to engage@cfpublic.org or send a talkback on the Central Florida Public Media app and let us know how it's impacting your community. There is more ahead here on Engage. Central Florida was part of a story that shocked the world. This week marks 40 years since a Challenger disaster. We revisit that day and the impact it still has on our space coast. This is Engage on Central Florida Public Media.
There's a lot going on in space, from efforts to land astronauts on the moon
and liftoff of Artemis 1
to answering the age-old question, are we alone in the universe?
Wouldn't you want to know if there was life on another planet?
Are We There Yet? Explores space exploration every Tuesday at 6:30 here on Central Florida Public Media.
You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Sharon Stone. Ahead on the program, Engage travels to Lake Mary for a multilingual meetup group that sounds more like the Tower of Babel.
We get French, we get German, we get Portuguese, we get ASL, we get English, we get Creole. We also, get Japanese and Mandarin.
I'll test my Spanish out at the language exchange at Lake Mary's Rita's Cafe. First, here on Engage, those who were around in 1986... we'll never forget the horrific news from Cape Canaveral as Americans were riveted to TVs for the historic shuttle launch.
Engines throttling up, 3 engines now at 104%.
Challenger, go and throttle up.
Roger, go and throttle up.
Minute 15 seconds, velocity 2,900 feet per second, altitude 9 nautical miles, downrange distance 7 nautical miles.
On January 28th of that year, the Shuttle Challenger was lifting for its 10th mission, the 25th for the shuttle program that began just 5 years earlier. This mission would include Krista McAuliffe, a 37-year-old school teacher from Concord, New Hampshire. She was to deliver lessons that would be beamed from space into classrooms across the country, a first for both the NASA space program and a revolutionary leap in education. But 72 seconds after liftoff, NASA engineers knew something was wrong.
Flight controllers here looking very carefully at the situation. Obviously a major malfunction. We have a report from the flight dynamics officer that the vehicle has exploded. Flight director confirms that. We are looking at checking with the recovery forces to see what can be done at this point.
For the first time in the American space program, NASA lost a crew during a mission. It had been 19 years and one day since 3 astronauts died in a fire on the launch pad during an engine test, but America never lost one during a mission. The success of the Mercury missions and our voyages to the moon bolstered NASA's confidence to dangerous levels, and that culture contributed to the Challenger disaster. We now know that cold weather caused a seal on the booster rocket to fail, leaking hot, high-pressure fuel, leading to the explosion. Engineers at the booster's manufacturer had warned NASA about the threat. The agency moved ahead with the launch nonetheless. Adam Higginbotham is the author of Challenger, a true story of heroism and disaster on the edge of space, a book that examines the Challenger disaster and the multitude of factors that led to the tragedy. As we acknowledge the 40th anniversary of the passing of astronauts Dick Scobee, Michael Smith, Ellison Onizuka, Judith Resnick, Ronald McNair, and teacher Krista McAuliffe, we spoke with Higginbotham about what led to the Challenger disaster and what we've learned from it. Higginbotham begins by describing the pressures NASA felt from the vast publicity being generated by placing a civilian like McAuliffe on the mission.
I think because of the amount of attention that was brought to the mission, because it was the Teacher in Space mission, because she was the focal point of the mission, which really was NASA's intention all along, that added to the pressure to launch, because there had been so many delays in the shuttle launch previously that just the month before, I think it was delayed five times, which was a record for NASA. No previous manned spaceflight mission had been delayed that many times. And then the Challenger mission itself had been delayed twice already for quite embarrassing reasons. So there was a real sort of PR pressure to get the shuttle off the ground on the 28th for that reason. And certainly Krista McAuliffe's presence on the flight, you know, contributed to that just because it brought more attention to it. And so it added to the embarrassment NASA felt when they couldn't seem to get Challenger off the ground.
I want to ask you about the engineers that you mentioned. We know technically how Challenger failed. And we know that engineers of the booster rocket expressed concern about a cold weather launch on that January day in 1986. How did the culture at NASA allow the warning to go unheeded?
You know, the shuttle system was incredibly complicated, and it was really very experimental. The way in which the public had come to perceive the program by the time Challenger launched in January was a total misconception. And it was one that NASA had allowed to develop in the public imagination, which was a routinely flying spacecraft that really went into space and back on an almost kind of airline schedule. And there was really nothing dangerous about it at all. You know, they allowed the public to think that it was just like flying on an American Airlines plane from JFK to LAX or something. And that was one of the reasons why it was acceptable to fly, you know, civilians like Krista McAuliffe on it. But the truth was, it was horribly complex. The engineers that worked on it called it the most complicated machine in history. And the result of that was that every single part of it, you know, presented a problem in different ways. And although they were concerned about safety, they were looking at loads of other different parts of the system that they felt were almost certainly going to be at some point the root cause of a catastrophe. For example, that the main engines of the shuttle orbiter itself were so complex and overpowered and had repeatedly blown up or melted down or caught fire on the test stands before the first shuttle launch. So there was a lot of attention on those. And the solid rocket boosters themselves seemed, relatively speaking, to be, you know, one of the safest and most reliable parts of the system. Having said that, you know, there was also a long trail of red flags in the performance of these things that went back even before the launch of the first shuttle mission in 1981. But what happened really is that although they detected these faults very early on, the engineers who worked on the solid rocket boosters had studied the problems particularly with the O-ring seals that sealed the joints of the segments of the rocket together. And they thought they had come to understand what caused the problems and that they were something that was never going to pose a particularly serious risk. And over time, they just gradually expanded what they regarded as a level of acceptable risk. So as one flight after another left the ground and they experienced problems, but the problems didn't cause a catastrophe, they began to deem acceptable faults at a level that at the very beginning of the program, they would have seen as irredeemably dangerous. And the best analogy I can come up with is the one that Richard Feynman used when eventually the Rogers Commission published their report into what happened after the accident. And he compared it to a man playing Russian roulette and repeatedly spinning the chamber of a revolver and pulling the trigger. And when the gun didn't go off, just assuming it was perfectly safe to have another go.
For people listening who are too young to remember Challenger or maybe weren't even born yet, can you help us understand what it felt like in America that day?
I think that it was totally incomprehensible. I think that up to that point, NASA, despite, you know, suffering several quite serious accidents during the history of crewed spaceflight, had nonetheless got to 1986 as the agency that had astonishingly put men on the moon over and over again, an amazing achievement. And everything that they'd done since then, you know, had seemed to simply burnish the agency's reputation as being an organization that could do the seemingly impossible on a regular basis, that they could achieve whatever they set out to do. And I think that meant that on the day of the accident, you know, even people watching from the ground at Cape Canaveral really couldn't comprehend what was unfolding in front of them was really happening. And I remember, I was 17 at the time, I remember when I heard the news, that I found it totally incomprehensible that this agency that had seemed to be absolutely faultless could have really been responsible for killing seven astronauts live on television.
How did NASA rebuild public and congressional confidence?
I'm not sure that they ever really fully did rebuild congressional and public confidence. I think that one of the reasons that January the 28th, 1986 remains seared in the national consciousness is because it was something that forever shattered the illusion of the safety of spaceflight, of the idea of it of being a sort of grand adventure that could be conducted really without serious hazard. And I think that it also represented a national loss of innocence. After the Challenger accident, America's confidence in the future, in the promise of high technology, its optimism about what that technology might deliver, you know, that was badly damaged and in some ways just kind of winked out and has never really returned.
17 years later, Columbia broke apart over Texas in 2003. Were there lessons from Challenger that could have been used to prevent that?
Well, that was absolutely the conclusion of the Columbia Accident Investigation Board, whose report in the wake of the Columbia accident suggested that you know, many lessons that had been learned in 1986 and applied before the shuttle returned to flight after the accident in 1988 had either been forgotten or had never really been learned in the first place. And as a result, it was only after the Columbia accident that NASA set up this initiative called the Apollo Challenger Columbia Lessons Learned Program, which was devised with the specific intent of making sure that not only were those lessons definitely learned within NASA as an organization, but that they were never allowed to be forgotten again.
Looking at the way space flight is approached today, there's a shift to privatize companies. Are those lessons from Challenger being applied in the same way today?
Well, certainly the contracts that NASA has with private contractors like SpaceX and Boeing now have a requirement written into them that demand a chance of catastrophic failure during a mission of around, I think, 1 in 260. Now, after the Challenger accident took place, it became clear that the possibility of catastrophic failure during launch, particularly for the shuttle, had been 1 in 25. So that's an order of magnitude difference in the contracted requirements for those commercial partners. But I'm not certain whether or not the cultural lessons have been learned within any of those organizations or applied, if they haven't actually been learned over that period of time. And one of the kind of most stark indications of that uncertainty, I think, is that Sean Duffy, who was the acting administrator of NASA last year, the acting chief of the agency, you know, held a town hall with NASA employees in which he said that the agency should not let safety stand in the way of progress, which really, if you wanted to cook down the root causes of the Challenger accident to any single phrase, I mean, that pretty much encapsulates it, is that they didn't want to let safety stand in the way of progress.
Do you ever worry about complacency setting in again, just with the amped up frequency of launches and the lunar and Martian ambitions?
I think it's less a problem of complacency than of pressure from above and political pressure. I think management pressure, which was an element of what happened to cause the Challenger accident in combination with the kind of complacency and hubris that we've talked about. But I think now the pressure from above is definitely a concern, because you can see that there are, you know, former astronauts and engineers from NASA who've come forward to express serious concerns about the pace at which the Artemis program is being moved forward, despite serious safety concerns. And I think that's not complacency, that's administration pressing down and trying to make things go faster than perhaps engineers would feel is completely safe.
Adam, there's something I just can't let go of. I really want to go back to where we started. You said that the people, the stories, that's what inspired you to write the book. And we talked about the engineers. Is there another story of the human side that you want to make sure is not forgotten that you can share?
I think one that always immediately comes to mind is the story of Ron McNair, who just kind of overcame so many obstacles. He grew up in a segregated town in the South under circumstances where he and his brother would go out when school was out and pick cotton to earn extra money, and yet managed to go on to graduate from MIT with a doctorate in laser physics, but also became a black belt in karate and a quite gifted jazz saxophonist. To the extent that when I read the details of his story and talked to his widow Cheryl about him, I find it hard to believe that he hadn't already been the subject of a dedicated biopic. And then there's the story of Roger Beaujolais, who was one of the rocket engineers who tried so hard to stop the launch taking place. And his story I also found extraordinary. And in part, I only realized that because I found in the archives of the National Air and Space Museum, I found an unpublished memoir that he'd written and completed in 1999 before he died. And that charts exactly how he came to feel so strongly that he needed to make sure he did everything he could in the run-up to launch to try and stop it happening and to stop an accident happening. You know, ultimately, he and some of his colleagues from Morton Thiokol became whistleblowers as the investigation took place. And his life was really ruined by, I mean, not just the guilt that he carried as a result of trying and failing to stop the accident taking place, but also because of the way that he was treated and frozen out by not only his colleagues at Morton Thiokol, but people in the local community. You know, he was eventually diagnosed with PTSD. And after the Rogers Commission finished its investigation, he left Morton Thiokol and he never worked in the aerospace industry again. And there are stories as extraordinary as that all the way through the Challenger story from the beginning, I think.
Adam Higginbotham is the author of Challenger, a true story of heroism and disaster on the edge of space. When you live in Central Florida, winter usually means maybe grabbing a light jacket. But this week, words are being used to describe the weather that we don't hear very often. Frigid, Arctic, even snow. The cold headed our way could challenge records that haven't been touched since the 1930s. To help us sort out what's actually possible, here's Megan Borowski, senior meteorologist for the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network, starting with where we are now and what's coming next. Can we start with where we are now? Just, are we expecting cold weather for days? What's going on right now?
Yeah, so actually we're kind of warm, comparatively speaking. I mean, we did have a cool down over the weekend from that last winter storm, so we're warming up a little bit. That's not going to be long-lived because we have another nor'easter that it's going to be developing. Luckily, most of the weather from that will stay to our north over the Carolinas, although there is chatter about Gulf effect or ocean effect snow. I'll address that really quickly because it's out there and so we have to talk about it. It's kind of analogous to lake effect snow where, you know, you've got a really cold and dry air mass or a cold air mass flowing over warm waters, and the warm waters provide moisture for precipitation, but you've got the cold air overhead, and so you can have snow flurries that develop. There's a very, very low chance that we could see a flake really toward the west, toward the Gulf Coast over Citrus County, or, you know, even toward Cape Canaveral. That's not out of the realm of possibility either if the winds are due northerly. But again, very, very low chance, but I kind of just wanted to address the elephant in the room because everybody is talking about it on social media. But back to the actual storm system. It'll be approaching. We'll have a chance for showers overnight Friday into early Saturday. But really the bigger thing here is the cold front that's going to be pushing on through. Winds will get gusty. We could see wind gusts 20 to 30 miles an hour in the Orlando metro area on Saturday during the afternoon. Those winds will eventually die out overnight Saturday into early Sunday. We should start to see things alleviating a little bit, but we'll still have gusts potentially to about 20 miles an hour on Sunday. So that's the first thing, is getting breezy with this front coming through. The second thing is an Arctic air mass that is coming in behind it. It's kind of like an offshoot of the polar vortex coming on down. And we're looking at highs in the mid to upper 40s on Sunday. Now, Sunday morning, I guess we should talk about that first. There's an extreme cold watch in effect across all of Central Florida, and that will be upgraded to an extreme cold warning once we get closer to the actual onset of the cold. And what we're looking at is low temperatures on Sunday morning, overnight Saturday into Sunday, dropping potentially into the lower to mid 20s toward rural parts of Lake County, rural southeastern Marion County. We might actually dip to the upper teens. And then on top of that, of course, I mentioned winds will be gusting. Our wind chills will be in the teens on Sunday morning. So very frigid. High Sunday afternoon in the 40s. We should drop down to the 20s again overnight into Monday morning. Then Monday afternoon highs in the mid 50s. So it's going to be a bit of a cold snap here once this front comes through. I will say that it looks like we do warm up a little bit by the middle of the work week. We should actually be back to just about 70 degrees by the time we get to Wednesday. But this weekend certainly going to be a frigid start to the month of February.
Hearing you say the word frigid in Central Florida, that's unheard of. But is it really? How unusual is this cold snap historically for us?
Well, you know, each winter we have blobs of, for lack of a better term, blobs of polar air moving on in. What I will say is that the severity of the cold, we're going to be chasing record low temperatures on Sunday morning, and then our afternoon highs could be a record low high temperature. I know that sounds like an oxymoron, but it's the coldest afternoon high temperature. We could be chasing those records in the Orlando metro area. Looks like the forecast for Sunday is 46 at Orlando International, and that record was last broken in 1936. Looks like Leesburg, I think 45, and that record was last met in 1978. So this is the severity of the cold is really the thing that we're looking at. And of course, our low temperatures, again, we could be breaking lows. 25 is our forecast on Sunday. Our last record was set back in the 1930s. So very, very cold temperatures. I know there's concerns for agriculture because the growing season has started. We've seen the strawberries coming in from Plant City, and so we could have impacts to agriculture.
Anything else that you think residents who aren't used to this should know going into this cold weather?
Bring in any sensitive plants that you have in pots. Bring those in because we're going down to the 20s. Provide adequate shelter for your outdoor animals. If you've got, you know, dogs or cats who are typically outside, bring them in, especially overnight, Saturday into Sunday. And also, you know, if you are planning to have anything, you know, do any outdoor plans over the weekend, maybe reconsider until it's a little more comfortable. And, you know, if you are going out, especially in the mornings, dress in layers. I know a lot of us like to work out in the morning or walk the dog in the morning. It's going to be cold. So please dress in layers. And also, you know, if we do have a couple sprinkles coming on through overnight Saturday into Sunday with those temperatures dropping, we may see black ice. You know, it is possible with our surface temperatures dropping. So keep that in mind as well. I know these are things typically, if I'm a meteorologist up in the Northeast, I'd be talking about this every weekend, but not expecting to be talking about Gulf effect snow and ocean effect snow for a Florida market. But here we are.
Megan Borowski is senior meteorologist for the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Coming up on Engage, the language of learning.
We head to a judgment-free zone in Lake Mary, where people are making friends, laughing, and practicing speaking French, Mandarin, German, and more. Estás escuchando Engage on Central Florida Public Media.
The Wrap is a podcast from Central Florida Public Media, curating the top Central Florida news stories and in-depth reporting each week. Join me, Brendan Byrne, as I bring you news headlines, deep reporting dives, and insightful conversations from the news team. A new episode of The Wrap every Friday morning. Get it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Sharon Stone. Restaurant and bar promotions are quite common for drumming up business. Twofers, ladies' night, karaoke, bar trivia, you know, we've seen it all. A cafe in Lake Mary came up with a unique way to increase traffic. Every Saturday at 6 is language night at Rita's Cafe.
Sabor amaro.
Ah, como café.
Sí, como café. Cualquier. Como pues eso es la café de, el café de Argentina.
Full disclosure here, estoy aprendiendo español. And I've been trying to work up the nerve and courage to go to that language meetup and practice talking with people in Spanish. So when Engage producer Richard Copeland pitched the idea as a segment for the show, it gave me that push I needed. So on a warm Saturday evening, we ventured out to Lake Mary, where we met Derek Hartwigson, owner of Rita's Cafe and originator of the language exchange. Derek is originally from Seattle. He moved here a year and a half ago with his family and saw potential in a little cafe nestled between a Sunrail station and a large apartment complex.
I think our first language event, we probably had 20 people attend, and that was cool. We've had great response from the community. Like, I'm not a coffee connoisseur. I wouldn't open a coffee business just for coffee. I opened the business so we could do a language exchange program, and the idea has kind of evolved as more people have come. It's so cool, man, seeing different people come together to learn, to improve. So the nights, they usually start more academic. People are talking in the language, and I want people to come together and stuff. In fact, the whole idea and concept has kind of morphed because originally I wanted it to be a language cafe, but now I kind of just want to bring like the community together.
The idea is simple. People working on language skills are invited to attend. Tables are set up with little signs denoting languages.
We get French, we get German, we get Portuguese, we get ASL, we get English, we get Creole. We also like get Japanese and Mandarin.
And there is a Spanish table, which is where I tried out my skills by talking about my cats.
Margaret.
Margaret?
Okay.
Mopar.
Motor parts. Get it?
Mopar.
Per.
See? Okay. Lo me gusta.
The weekly event draws a diverse crowd with language skills at all levels. Some are foreign-born, looking to preserve their culture and share it with others. Some are looking to beef up their academic experience with something more conversational. And some simply stumble upon the meetup.
It was like a Saturday. I was off that Saturday, and I didn't have like any plans. And I was like, you know, I want to do something. Like, I want to do something crazy today. Then I was like browsing the Orlando subreddit, and I found like a post saying that there's a language event at 6 p.m. And then I was like, why not? And then I just came here. And, you know, that's how it began.
That's Cesar Garcia of Orlando. The 21-year-old has been studying Japanese for years.
I am trying to practice my spoken Japanese. I know the language. I'm fluent in what it's like reading and the vocab and all that. I just need to like pick up conversational, actual interactions like face to face.
And that's exactly what Cesar finds at the language exchange.
We do have some native people, which is amazing. Every once in a while we have like regular natives and then native that come like every once in a while. And then we have other people that are like multilingual, they know Japanese fluently. So I kind of like try to like establish a conversation with them in Japanese as much as I can.
Some of the attendees bring a plethora of languages with them. For Orlando and Ashim Sapkota, the language exchange feels like home.
I grew up in Shanghai, China. So obviously when you live in China, you kind of learn Chinese. And so I've been speaking Chinese since I was one. And my family's from Nepal, so then Nepalese and Hindi are part of, you know, that culture. My dad graduated from Russia, so sometimes he messed with me when I was a kid and spoke to me in Russian, so I kind of picked up for no reason for that one. And then obviously learned English when I was growing up. And on top of that, my mom made me take Spanish classes, so kind of made me speak seven altogether.
Fluency in seven languages can be both useful and fun, as Ashim explained.
I like to go to like restaurants and try to use them on people who traditionally speak those languages. It's a lot of fun. And sometimes even like, this is like a guilty pleasure type of thing, but sometimes if you know a language and somebody doesn't know you know that language, it's kind of nice to surprise them all of a sudden and they're like, oh, really?
At the German table, a gaggle of players are gathered around a Scrabble board, all shuffling the lettered tiles to spell out words in German.
Can we put it here or no?
Also jetzt, das ist M oder
ja.
Kann
sie, M
kann
das, ist so wow, ja, du kannst, aber du musst dann trotzdem noch mit dem hier, mit dem hier oder mit dem hier zusammen.
Ja, das steht hier für M, ja.
And it was at this table where we met Troy and his 13-year-old son, Daniel. Troy is a marketing strategist originally from Denmark, but has lived all over the world and picked up several languages. He started coming to the language meetups to connect with others in the community, and Daniel started tagging along to practice his Chinese. In 2 years of study, Daniel has developed conversational Mandarin, and he has big plans to use it.
I want to become a mechanical engineer when I grow up, and a lot of mechanical engineers work in China. And if I become fluent in Chinese by the time I'm done with college, I can get a really good job in China because I understand the language fluently.
In addition to the spoken languages, there is a table for people who use American Sign Language to connect. Odette Kelly of Sanford is hearing impaired and leads the group in sign.
I come here every Saturday night to teach them ASL because they want to learn so they can communicate with the deaf people. So I'm here to help them and teach them how to sign.
Odette says the ASL table at the Language Exchange attracts people who rely on ASL, as well as students of sign language looking to practice.
All my friends that want to learn, I told them to come down here to learn ASL. They got excited, and they all come here. And we used to get a lot of people. Sometimes we get a little bit, and we get like 20 people now. We also have a lot of deaf people come here, and they teach them how to sign and communicate with them.
Back at the Spanish table, I met Sam Lancaster, a 24-year-old with a passion for linguistics and a desire to use language to connect to his roots.
I've had a lifelong goal of wanting to learn Italian because my family is Italian-American. When they came to this country, they spoke Italian, they spoke Neapolitan, and eventually they were forced to stop because of the social pressures of the time in the 1940s and the 1950s, and they never passed that heritage on. And it's something that's really hurt my family. Everybody in my family wants to know Italian, and it's just a part of the culture we lost. We talk about it all the time. We have a deep love for the old country, and I feel like I'm bringing part of that culture back by learning it and eventually by teaching it to my family.
Sam was apprehensive when he first came to the language exchange, but he quickly found a community within the coffee shop.
I actually found this from an online forum. I was really worried whenever I first came here because I was going to be like, oh, it's a bunch of nerds. But I came and everyone's so hospitable and I just really love it here.
And he has advice for those first timers with language anxiety.
Put one foot in front of the other, come out and accept the suck, accept the anxiety. It's something that I had to do. I used to be a very nervous kid. And now it feels pretty easy to make friends because we're all humans. We all have the same needs. We all have the same wants. And we all need to treat each other with dignity.
Beyond beefing up their language skills, what the people attending Rita's Cafe Language Exchange are really finding is friendship and community, as Sam explains.
I'm originally from Alabama, so Orlando is a complete culture shock to me. I was completely out of my element. And there's just such a love here that I think is very hard to put into words. It really is like a third space. You come here, you make friends, you know, you buy stuff to help out the owner, but really it's friendship. It's all friendship.
And those words are music to owner Derek Hartwigson's ears. Yes, the Language Exchange is a promotion to bring people through the doors of the business,
But Derek's real goal is using Rita's Cafe to develop a community.
The people have developed friendships. They hang out outside of the shop. I hear about people going hiking and doing other things, going out for food together.
You can attend the language exchange at Rita's Cafe on Saturday evenings at 6. Well, links on our website, cfpublic.org. That's all for today's edition of Engage. Subscribe to the Engage podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify so you don't miss an episode. I'm Sharon Stone. Thank you for the company. NPR News is next.